Welcome to Shattering This, a program devoted to what has become the largest segment of society. To those of you who have come to realize that the world's political, religious, military, economic, and media institutions are corrupt, that they've become counterproductive, they're actually part of the problem, and that they cannot be resolved. Our phone number, if you would like to participate in a discussion on these matters, is toll-free 877-300-7645. I guess it had to happen someday. The plane that never should have been built. The boondoggle of arrogance, the F-22 Raptor, was actually used in the U.S. airstrikes in Syria over the last 2 days. It's the first combat mission for the stealth fighter. This, of course, is an airplane that was designed by committee. It is an airplane that doesn't do anything well, and it's an airplane that is way too expensive to build and to operate. It is an airplane that plays into the ego of America, that we can outspend the rest of the world combined on spying and on war making, and that that will somehow make us safe rather than more vulnerable to the thing that actually crashed the Soviet Union, which was trying to maintain a military beyond its economic capability. Well, nonetheless, this boondoggle of an airplane was in operation against a foe that doesn't even have an air force, against a foe that has no radar installations, against a foe that, to the best of our knowledge, doesn't have an air defense system. And yet, the brain trust of the Pentagon thought, I've got the perfect airplane for that. Let's fly the latest, greatest, most expensive airplane over a foe that has no air defenses, that has no air force, that has no airplanes. That is the perfect use of the ultimate American weapon. And so we did. It is called a momentous decision for the United States Air Force to deploy this new jet. And all that along, I have been saying that there was never a need for a new fighter, that America doesn't have a foe, that a stealth intercept fighter is going to be valuable. The Russians have no interest in invading America. As a matter of fact, the Russians, unlike America, are no longer globalists. The Chinese have, as America, their largest market. They own what they wish to own in America. There is a 0% possibility that the Chinese, who, like the Russians, already have more land than they know what to do with, more resources than they can consume, would reach out for elbow room and try to occupy America. 0% chance of that. None. So who are we going to use our fancy new fighter against? What's the purpose other than to satisfy the egos of politicians looking for jobs in the defense industry in their region and the egos of generals and admirals in the U.S. military? Who are we going to put it up against? I mean, there is nobody that is a reasonable villain today. I mean, we're trying to make them, sure, around the world, but this is not an airplane that is going to do any good against fundamental Islamic terrorists. Oh, yes, we just used it against fundamental Islamic terrorists, but that's sort of like saying that, you know, I want to start a bonfire in my backyard for a camp out. So I think the best way to start it is not with a match, but I'm going to request that the U.S. send in a cruise missile. And with a million-dollar missile, they can certainly ignite my bonfire. Well, yeah, they can. Is it sane? No. Is it efficient? Of course not. Is it effective? Not in the wildest imagination. Matter of fact, when we continue to send $100 million jets with million-dollar bombs against a foe that is lethal with a $100 rifle, then we lose. No matter how many of them we kill, the numbers never add up. Let's just say that we were stunningly successful in the deployment of our $100 million jets, all of which required another 50 hours of maintenance in preparation for, and another 50 hours in maintenance and the aftermath of their mission, much less the aircraft carriers with crews of 5,000 churning out in the ocean on nuclear power plants, on all of the jet fuel. And let's just say that with this force dropping million-dollar precision bombs, that we killed 50 fundamental Islamic terrorists. And let's say that we destroyed 50 guns in the process. Yeah, the math of that would be, you know, in the range of it cost us $1 billion and we cost them a few hundred thousand. You can't win. The more you play, the more you lose. It's the math of miscalculation, and that we're engaged in it full force today. Yes, we deployed a new weapon, one that never should have been built, one that doesn't have any viable purpose, one that is so expensive to operate that every time we use it, America loses. But that aircraft's stealth capabilities were really, really important over the desert when there's no air defense system, no radar. And it can deliver its payload from 15 miles away. Which is important how? I mean, under these circumstances, how does that have any merit? Quote, it has a unique ability to approach adversaries in a way legacy aircraft can't. Oh, yeah? How? We have lots of stealth aircraft. We have lots of aircraft that can fire missiles from 15 miles away. What is it about this airplane that would have caused a difference from any other legacy airplane that cost tens of millions to build as opposed to over $100 million to build? I mean, tell me. Is there anything that would have made a difference against the Islamic State, for crying out loud? I mean, our president said not only are they not Islamic, they're not even a state. Well, if they're not a state, they can't have an army. They don't have an army, then you're using a $100 million weapon, bunches of them, against a ragtag group of jihadists. Gee, that seems smart, huh? There are things the F-22 is uniquely suited to address that other fighters in our inventory can't. Okay. So what? I didn't think that the Islamic State had fighters. The Pentagon did not give the details on what targets the Raptors hit, in part because the officials are still conducting reviews of the airstrike. You know, it's interesting that when Yahweh was taking America to task in the 18th chapter of Yeshaya Isaiah, he specifically speaks of our gleaming birds of prey. The raptor, of course, is a bird of prey. We're still assessing the effectiveness of these strikes because we believe we hit what we were aiming at. Navy Rear Admiral John Kirby the Pentagon press secretary said during an appearance on MSNBC. Can you imagine getting that promotion to Rear Admiral, and your job is to be a press secretary? And your big announcement is, we're still assessing the effectiveness of these strikes. That's because we really don't have a lot of intelligence there. But we think, well, we believe, actually, we hit what we were aiming at. Swell. Yesterday, I was bemoaning a trend that I find obnoxious. It is that the teleprompter readers who read the nightly news are now positioning themselves and are being positioned as experts whose opinions matter. This is an example. It's an article that is a published editorial by Carol Castello. I never heard of Carol Castello, but she is the anchor, oh boy, of the teleprompter readers of the 9 to 11 Eastern Time edition of CNN's Newsroom, which makes her an expert on what's happening in the world today.
What do you think, Scott? You thought my self-proclaimed genius thing last week was a joke.
I did a whole segment on your self-proclaimed genius.
I'm going to keep adding titles, expert, genius, I mean, anything else I need to add.
I think you probably could have done a better job than did Carol Costello. In fact, feel free to add your genius to this review of her editorial. She begins, Joint Chiefs Chair Martin Dempsey made no bones about it. He believes the U.S. troops advising the Iraqis in the fight against ISIS should aid them in a combat role. He will seek permission from the president. What she's trying to say is that we're fully expecting, regardless of the president's denial, that we will have combat troops on the ground in Iraq and Syria. She goes on beyond that, and it gets worse. I want you to listen to the lack of thought, the lack of reason, the lack of judgment by her. President Obama and most lawmakers say American boots on the ground will not happen. But you know how that goes. As Senator Lindsey Graham said of ISIS in Syria, quote, it's going to take an army to beat an army. This idea will never have any boots on the ground to defeat them in Syria is fantasy, end quote. So what she's saying is that American politicians lie. And there is this thing called mission creep with the Pentagon that they want to get their toe in the water so that America is committed, because it's really easy to get into wars. Yeah, we just got into a new war, Syria. And it was really easy to invade Afghanistan, really easy to invade Iraq. Not hard to get involved in a war. What's hard is getting out of the war. And so since politicians and the Defense Department don't like admitting that every time they've engaged in the last 50 years, they've lost, they just hang around to somehow get what we called, what was Nixon's term, peace with honor. Yes, we look for peace with honor. Yes, it's Vietnam. We made a bad situation worse. We broke a country. We lost 57,000 Americans in the process. 2 million Vietnamese perished. We squandered billions of dollars. And the nation was in worse shape, not better shape, after we left. And the Viet Cong quickly overran the country. There was no honor. And there was no peace. We just lied. We just hung on until people were so worn down, they were willing to accept the lie. Well, welcome to Syria, circa 2014. So I, like many Americans, says the newsreader, worry. Oh, she's a worrier. Oh, boy, isn't it nice to know that your newsreader is a worrier? She says our troops are amazingly skilled and courageous in theater. Oh, boy. They're courageous in theater. Maybe she's seen some of war movies in theaters and seen, yeah, boy, those guys, those actors, man, they are courageous. But a stunning number of them do not fare well psychologically once they come home. The United States appears to have one of the highest rates, as she says, rate, but I think she meant to say rates, of veteran soldiers. I don't know why she would hyphenate veteran slash soldiers. Aren't veterans former soldiers? Veteran soldiers suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome in the world. Yes, because we invented the concept. According to the General Health Questionnaire, U.S. soldiers experience PTSD at rates of 29%. Almost a third. Almost a third. Now, what you may want to question here is that a disproportionate number of soldiers actually engage in combat. You know, even those who are, you know, it's the minority of U.S. Military personnel that are actually engaged in theater in a country where a war is going on. So it's the minority. And then it's a minority of those who actually see combat. So a minority of a minority. And yet you have a third saying that they have experienced post-traumatic stress syndrome. You have more veterans and soldiers, active soldiers and veterans, former soldiers, claiming to be a victim of post-traumatic stress syndrome than those who have actually experienced stress in a battlefield by a margin almost of 2-1. And, of course, we out-stress, out-traumatize Britain 2-1 because their ratio is 16%. What's more troubling is the suicide rate. Now, this is where people ought not pretend to be experts when they're news readers. She read, 22 veterans commit suicide every day. That's a suicide every 65 minutes. That's 8,000 veterans a year. Oh, she thinks she's so smart because she did the division and she did the multiplication and she remembered what she read. But she didn't think. That's not the number. It's not even close to the number. 22 veterans are recorded committing suicide every day in states that represent 40% of the American population. And in those states that represent 40% of the U.S. population, only 70% of the veteran suicides are correctly attested. So the head newsreader for CNN has decided to share something that she read. And what she read is, what's more troubling is the suicide rate. 22 veterans commit suicide every day. That's a suicide every 65 minutes. That's 8,000 veterans a year. No, it's not. You know, all you have to do is to look at the study that came up with the 22 veterans committing suicide every year. It was published about 6 months ago. The first thing that you find in that study, when you're, after you know, you read the news report and it's sensationalism, and you go down and say, all right, what was the basis of the study? The first thing they say is that only 40% of the states representing 40% of the U.S. population even report on veteran suicides. So that means that the number is automatically 60% larger than what you're reporting. And then you find that in the states that actually report an association between veterans and suicides, that they only get 70% of them, that 30% of them are not conveyed. Now, when you do the math to increase the 22 in the states representing 40% of the population to correlate it to 100% and therefore increasing by 30, and then add the 60% of states that don't report, because there's no reason to think that the larger states are somehow immune from what returning vets from smaller states are doing, you find that the number of veterans committing suicide every day isn't 22. It's 80. And when you multiply 80 by 365, and then you multiply that by the 10 years that this has been occurring, you find that the real death toll from America's suicidal invasions of Iraq and Iran, and the legacy of those miscalculations of wars based on lies, isn't 8,000 even a year. It's 300,000. The invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan are more deadly than was Vietnam when you include suicides, which are a legacy of those wars. And then on top of that, you have to calculate that it's not just a percentage of up to 29% of veterans claiming post-traumatic stress syndrome. It's the fact that there are 650,000 U.S. veterans collecting $6,000 a month having claimed post-traumatic stress syndrome. That's equal to the entire active duty force of the Marines and of the Army who would have actually engaged in a military combat situation. That's how out of whack we are. And when you're that out of whack, and you add to it the fact that rapes are 80% more common in the military, and that a woman is four times more likely to be sexually harassed in the military than she is outside of it, you realize that we have a disaster on our hands, that we're making America decidedly weaker, more deadly, with the deployment of our military. We're not taking into consideration the consequence of deploying this murderous machine. We have Glenn, who has been patient on hold here. Glenn, I'm disgusted. How about you?
Oh, yeah. Well, does the term crumbling empire ring a bell?
Yeah, I studied Rome. I studied, actually, Babylon, Assyria, the fall of Greece and the fall of Rome, because, you know, predicted their demise before three of those empires were even conceived. And I wanted to understand why he was so negative, so opposed, particularly to Rome, and spoke so negatively about the rise and fall of Greece, and why he spoke of the idea that out of the fall of the Roman Empire would become a monster far more vicious and deadly than the Roman political and military construct ever was, and that it would continue right to the very end of time. Then that being, of course, the Roman Catholic Church. And so, I've spent a lot of time, wrote a couple of hundred pages on the fall and demise of empires, and suicide is a very prevalent common denominator, as is sexual abuse, as is a inability to convey the truth in a rational or logical way. All of these are telltale signs that America is on not only the decline, but is right next to its ultimate demise.
Right, right. That's crazy stuff. I you also think about the statue, you know, and Daniel with the legs of iron and then the feet of iron and clay, partly weak and partly strong. And I look at that, and I can't help getting away from the fact that I keep thinking of the idea that Adam is clay, and democracy is government of the people, sort of like a clay, you know, all these creatures of clay, supposedly forming the government, yet it's being, but the democracies are behaving imperialistically. So I sort of view the iron and clay feet as sort of like the era of imperial democracy, you know, these supposedly democratic countries behaving imperialistically.
Yeah, it's sort of an interesting deal, because you are correct. The thing that God is most opposed to are human institutions, because human institutions promise victory, they promise salvation, they promise security, they make all sorts of economic, military, and political promises, and none of their promises are truthful or reliable. And so you look at Adam. The Hebrew word Adam means clay, dirt. And of the dirt, of the clay, and now you have this monstrous construct that is of man, that rules the last days, and it's spoken of as clay. The thing that I know that you realize is that while the West uses the term democracy, there is no democracy in the in the world today. The last democracy was Sparta.
I consider democracy to be a degenerative state preceding tyranny.
It is the term as it is deployed today is the tyranny of the majority over the minority. And that's really what it has become. And truly, the nations that are pound their chests as being the most puritanical democracies, particularly the United States, is the most aggressive as an imperialist nation. You know, we are invading every country as if it is ours. We're making the dictates, as the prophecy in Yeshaya 18 warned, we're running off our mouth as if the Ukraine is ours to govern. China is ours to contain, as if Russia is ours to control.
And Syrian airspace is ours to transgress.
It's our private domain that we're completely legal and flying over and bombing Syria, as we were legal in invading Iraq, as it was legal and appropriate for us to invade Afghanistan, as it's appropriate for us to fly our drones over Somalia and Yemen and Pakistan and kill whomever we please.
And some British legislatures, like, even mentioned this, how the United States is always the first to be out there talking about the international community and international law, but when it wants to defy international law, it's like nobody's supposed to say anything, you know. Right. But I originally called to talk about warplanes, because it's if it weren't so sad, it would be humorous. I mean, the F-22 Raptor, when it's not asphyxiating its pilots, it's a stealth aircraft, but it's vastly outperformed by the Su-35, the Sukhoi-35, which has maneuvering nozzles in all three axes, whereas the Raptor only has maneuvering nozzles in two axes. Right. And, you know, there's Russian dogfighters. I mean, in a dogfight, you know, there's no way they could win. And you sure won't find the F-35 pressed into service anytime soon. For a mission that could be, carried out very well by a nice swing wing F-14 Super Tomcat. That's right. We retired all
those. We retired all of those. Yes. The reality is that a more maneuverable airplane sounds great until you realize there aren't going to be any more dogfights.
Dogfights are a thing
of the past. Maneuverability is irrelevant now. Even if we had a foe for which intercept fighters were going to play a role. I mean, we're still trying to fine-tune our approach in World War II, as if we still had enemies as they existed in World War II. And in that situation, a maneuverable fighter was a favorable thing. But today, fighters don't even see each other when they engage. It's all about the weapons that lock onto one another.
Miles away.
Yes. Scores of miles away in some
over
cases.
The horizon, yeah.
And realistically, there is no country that has any intention of invading the United States, nor destroying the United States. And so there is no purpose for these fighters. Air superiority over combat troops means nothing because we shouldn't deploy our combat troops. I mean, we made a bad situation worse in Iraq, worse in Afghanistan, and we'll make a bad situation worse in Syria.
And especially, like, for example, literally anything that needs to be done could be done with that four Phantoms, for crying out loud, at this point. You know, if you want to go F-15s at the latest.
Well, they have no air defense capability, why not fly the B-52s over before you mothball them?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm sure they do. They've warned the Syrians not to light up their aircraft.
We told the Syrians, here we come. We're going to bomb those who are trying to take your country. I mean, who would have thought 2 years ago we wanted to bomb Damascus and kill Assad, and now we're running military operations for Assad? But nonetheless, he has stood down because what we're doing is in his interest. And so there's no air defense. Fly B-52s. Dr. Joel Voskin, a clinical psychologist. That would be somebody, of course, that we can trust because he is a mind doctor. And, of course, I've never met a psychiatrist or psychologist that didn't need one. He says that it was William Sherman who said, "War is hell. As far back as there have been wars, there have been people who didn't handle war well." Okay, so if war is hell, why do we go to hell? If war is hell, why do we go to hell? Now, don't tell me that we went into Korea because America's national interests were at stake. Don't tell me that we sacrificed all those lives in Vietnam because America's security was at stake. Don't tell me that American freedom was at stake in Afghanistan or in Iraq, because you'd be lying through your teeth. So why do we engage in hell? Why do we go into hell when we're accomplishing nothing? In fact, making each of those situations worse, we're making it hell. We're opening the doors of hell. The psychiatrist told the newsreader, "Most people are affected significantly by killing." Gee, that's a newsflash. You know, Glenn, I am just stunned. I mean, this is just so counterintuitive that most people are affected significantly by killing. Can you imagine that?
Yeah, that's bizarre. I can't imagine. Well, and also not to mention when you have stop loss and four or five tours or more, and then you've got people doing really immoral things, I would think the cumulative effect of that could actually be significant, really.
You know, it is killing anything. I don't care if you're just out hunting. Killing chips away at your soul. Now, I understand, and I have no issue with a hunter that hunts in the most merciful way possible to kill an animal expressly for food. You know, I have people who are associated with our farm who love venison and not only eat all of the human edible parts, but their dogs consume the parts that we as humans would not eat. And they love it. And, you know, there is really no difference in my view in harvesting a deer and harvesting and having hamburger or chicken.
Well,
or turkey.
Actually, the hunter who puts a 30-06 round behind the shoulder right into the heart, drops the deer instantly, is killing the animal much more mercifully than a slaughterhouse for cows.
Yeah, that's probably true. I wouldn't debate that, and I don't have an issue with that. But people who hunt for sport, they chip away little bits of their soul. And people who kill humans chip away at little pieces of their soul. This psychiatrist told the newsreader, for most people, it's not a joyful experience. For some, it's mildly traumatizing. For others, it's extremely traumatic. Now, by the way, the majority of those who are suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome, the overwhelming preponderance, haven't killed anybody. The overwhelming preponderance of them haven't even witnessed someone being killed.
Yeah, and this is coming from... This is coming from a pencil neck who's never done a push-up on a military base.
Yes. I'm a Jeffersonian in the sense that I view an established military as being the most counterproductive thing that a country can do relative to its freedom, relative to an honest and open debate, relative to... economic policy that is based on the interest of the people as opposed to those who rule over the people. And so I would eliminate it. But the fact of the matter is we ought not lie about it. We have created a military in America that is a tremendous liability. It's a tremendous liability in terms of sexual assault. Because of its own suicide rates, because of its dependence on use of post-traumatic stress syndrome and the legacy costs associated with that, and the fact that it has been deployed since 1950 consistently to break countries, to make bad situations worse. We haven't achieved anything with our military worthwhile in 60 years.